sculpture which you named Mozart's Birthday. Yeah. Did you name it? When did it come to naming that sculpture? Have you guys finished it or what?
You've just come from the studio that I built it, where I built it. It took me about 3 years to build that piece of sculpture. And Kate's brother, Peter, my lady, Kate's brother said to me, you know, like, your birthday and my birthday are on the same day, but it's on the same day as Mozart. And I thought, well, Mozart's birthday, you know, like, wonderful. But then he was wrong. Although he's terrific as a jazz musician, he was wrong about the date of birth of Mozart. But I love Mozart's work. There's a great piece of his that's called Exultate Jubilate, which is one of those moments of human passion, joy, unity, where you have, and it just rises with the capacity that life has to give a wholeness to all of our existence, and reconciles all of it with this kind of like embrace, paradoxical embrace.
Now you have another sculpture that Storm King called Pyramidion.
Pyramidion.
That has to do with an apex of some kind.
There's only one stone in any of the pyramids in Egypt that is formed in that special way, which has five different sides to it. And in the Louvre, in the great museum in Paris, there is one or perhaps two of them. They're ultra rare, but it is a moment. I named it that because I had started that piece many, many years ago, and it had been unfinished for many years. And then Peter Stern really insisted that they wanted it up in Storm King, so I ended up finishing the piece. Finally, you know, we were driven by different kinds of pressures. And that piece is a very strange piece for me. I tend not to do very symmetrical pieces. I used to believe that asymmetry preceded symmetry, that asymmetry is the way we are, and that I liked radical asymmetry as I began my sculptural life. And but that's a very symmetrical piece. There's a sense, I think, in that kind of landscape of openness, of when you feel the relationship between the Richard Serra and the way that it deals with the distant mountains and the hill, where suddenly the hill itself becomes a part of the part of the work of art, or the Andy Goldsworthy as it loops through the trees in a very bizarre way, which has nothing to do with fencing in and out. It's there is in a setting like Storm King, you have a capacity to see works that is much, how can I put it, much more natural, much more electric in terms of nature as life than the white walls of a museum. And that's the great importance of what Storm King has achieved. It's a long-term vision, and I'm sure that not just this generation, but the next generation will appreciate it more and more. As I remembered it, Ted Ogden had already put in the columns, so it had that view, but the fields were like all bramble bushes. There wasn't a sense of openness. There were cornfields there, and cornfields have a very, they have a beauty of their own with the way that the striping of the landscape can happen. But it was not like concentrated the way it is now. Now there is this handling of the fields and the sculpture where you don't have like a geometric center to each to each piece, where each piece is installed like that. There's a very sensitive relationship of how the pieces go with the forest and the meadows and the paths. And when I was talking about the way that art changes the urban city, here in Socrates, we tried to do something that was wide open so that the artists could do many different things. And it's very much harder in a 4-acre place than in the hundreds of acres that is there in Storm King. I think that Storm King shows landscape at a level of the, that kind of romantic vision that you have in that Hudson River Valley paintings. If you can work with the materials and the tools that allow you to find what that art is offering to you. You know, we come to it with all the memory of all the other artists that have shown us what the capacity is, and then you're able to master the materials, you're able to master the tools of it, then you can come to that moment of surprise. And the surprise is a wonderful thing for not just children, but for grown-ups too.
Absolutely. You have a sculpture of a friend up there, is it not, for Chris?
Yes.
Tell me about Chris.
Chris was a beautiful sculptor, a beautiful man who was tormented, who worked with glass. And at first he worked with wood. I didn't realize until after he died how much he had loved and admired me. He came to this city with his beautiful wife, and they lived in a loft downtown. And we traded pieces of sculpture. He took one of my swings, which is a kind of a mobile participational thing, and he gave me a piece which I've given to the Berkeley Art Museum. He worked with glass and steel in a way that was so different from the coldness that you find in skyscrapers so often in architecture, where it's blankly done and repeated, where the module becomes like the only moment of expression. He used to. And I saw these works. Actually, we worked on a piece together. His first piece that he built, I said to him, I'll do the steel, you do the glass, and he did it. It's ended up in a collection that will end up in a museum, in the Broida collection. And he used to play guitar to himself, kind of a country western, and he was a very beautiful man and very, very torn, and he tried to build a studio. He came here and he saw the way we were working, and he tried to do it in a different way in Brooklyn, and the Brooklyn Loft Board tormented him and made him take out showers out of it, because they said, yeah, loft, you can't live in a loft. And it was so difficult for him that he eventually committed suicide. And so I built a piece in memory of him. And it had, it has a bell in it that you can ring. And it's, of course, refers to the John Donne poem, For Whom the Bell Tolls.